Welcome, everyone, to Unconventional Lifestyles. Today we have Greg LaHaye on the podcast. And Greg and I met in Alaska in Denali National Park, where he operates Cantishan Air Taxi. And I was working for them in 2015, became great friends. Greg's also been to Antarctica, just can't seem to get away from that continent in my line of work and my past. He's done all kinds of stuff. And on top of that, this episode is one of my favorites because of the wisdom and the guidance, mentorship. I've always looked to Greg as a friend, but a mentor as well. He's just got a great head on his shoulders, and he's a great dude, doing things all for the right reasons and really watching out and taking care of people. He's very selfless and very motivating to get off your ass and get some shit done. I would like to take a moment to thank my sponsors. This podcast is sponsored in part by no one. However, I would not necessarily be opposed to changing that. If you find value here and would like to know more about sponsorship incentives, then email me at wit@witaldridge.com. That's WHIT@WHITALDRIDGE. Aloha, Brother Greg. How are you doing today, sir?
Hey, doing great, Whit. How's it going on your end?
It's good, man. Just a pleasure to have you on the podcast today. It's been a while since we've talked, but I've definitely been wanting to get you on here. Where are you, and what are you up to right now?
We reside in the little island of Kauai, the northernmost island of the chain here, of the main islands of Hawaii. And it's our winter haunt for typically 4 to 5 months a year. So we're here till from right around just after Christmas till mid-April, late May this year.
And then what's next after that?
We're going to do a little trip up the coast of California, go camp in the Redwoods, go see a bunch of friends up through probably Oregon and into Washington. And then Elise starts, she gets on a boat and does her guiding starting from Seattle up to Alaska, and then I'll fly back to Alaska to get the season going in May.
Nice. Sounds like a good plan. So you're originally from Michigan, and you spend your summers in Alaska in Denali National Park, and your winters in Kauai. So how did you end up in Alaska to begin with? Like how did this whole like dual or I guess like seasonal winter summer lifestyle enter your realm of existence?
Yeah, well, I was going to school at Michigan State University, you know, 40,000 people there. It was a bit overwhelming. I was working 3 jobs to pay for it. And I had just gotten back the summer before from volunteering down at Big Bend National Park in Texas. And so I really got used to being out in the wilderness, and had done a field trip in geology, which, you know, took me to the Four Corner States, and that really got me hooked on the mountains. And so I kind of had that in my belly that, you know, I definitely wanted to live in a really beautiful mountainous place. And then I met that junior year in college, a buddy of mine who was a couple doors down in the dorm, had spent some summers in Alaska, and his brother and sister-in-law were living up in Denali Park. And, you know, he was always telling tales of them working 3-4 months a year and taking the winter off and dog mushing in the Brooks Range and shooting caribou and living off the land. And I was like, man, there's no way. You can't still do that kind of thing in the world. And he's like, dude, you got to get up there and check it out. It's blow your mind. You know, before you go, I was studying finance, and he was like, before you become a contender on Wall Street, why don't you take a summer and go check it out? And so, you know, on his suggestion, I just fired up an application and just got a job waiting tables at one of the restaurants there in Denali Park, which at that time there was basically just a couple operators and 100 plus employees, and things were, you know, really, really small up there. And I just got in, and the minute I landed there, I knew I was home and found my people, and everybody was of like mind, and it's just, you know, it was an amazing, beautiful place. And that was it. Came back to Michigan, started, you know, actually dropped out of Michigan State because I just couldn't stomach the idea of being in finance school anymore. My heart wasn't in it, even though I was in my senior year, but I was paying for it myself and working three jobs, and I was burnt out and couldn't see anything in the finance world that I could see long term that I could do without, you know, having a heart attack down the road. So just kind of followed my heart and, you know, got out of Dodge and went right back to Alaska.
No, I hear you on that. I remember when I first got to Alaska and I was working with you guys. And yeah, no, I totally feel you. It's like you get there, it's like, yeah, this feels like home. These are my people. Definitely missed it this past season. Definitely hope to get back up there at some point. But but yeah, I guess so. You spent some time as like a guide and whatnot in the backcountry as well before you became a pilot. How did you get into becoming a pilot? Did you know that that was something that you always wanted to do, or did it happen by happenstance?
Yeah, I kind of stumbled into it. I think in the back of my brain, I'd always loved the thought about being an aviator, but I kind of told myself, you know, made up a story that I wasn't smart enough or needed to understand math better, or, you know, it was just something that I felt I probably couldn't do in my life for some reason or another. And the post office up in Denali Park used to be at the train station, which is right next to the Denali Park airstrip. And so Denali Air, my friend Ron had been flying that business. And so I would grab my mail and go sit down by the airstrip and watch these planes come and go. And, you know, as I got to meet all these guys, I realized, you know, they're not rocket scientists, you know, average Joes who like have figured it out and have a little bit of dexterity and some good judgment. And so I really started getting excited about, you know, the fact that, oh, maybe I could do this. And, I don't remember, you know, I was trying to prepare for this, trying to remember if I took a flight. I spent that whole first summer backpacking around Denali and, you know, spending so much time on the bus and, you know, getting out every weekend. And even with that, I felt like I just saw just a small iota of what the park had to offer. And I must have gotten on a flight at one point in time, and just flying over the area, it just blew my mind how big it was, yeah, how vast it was. And then I realized, it's like, man, if I'm going to be in Alaska, I got to get my license. You know, I have to have the skill to be able to get out and see the rest of the world, since, you know, Alaska only has a third of the landscape there is covered by, you know, any kind of accessible road system. So that was it, you know. And then when I got back to Michigan, I realized I didn't want to continue with school. So as my then girlfriend was finishing her degree, I just jumped in, found a great old instructor at a little grass strip right there in East Lansing, who my friend had used to get his license. And, you know, it was just a match made in heaven, super great guy. He just turned 80. I still keep in great touch with him, and hoping to get further instruction from him, because I want to get my flight instructor license here soon and start giving back to all the kids in my life and those around me.
Well, sign me up, Greg.
Yeah, let's go.
No, that's awesome. And folks, Greg had mentioned spending a lot of time on the bus. Let me lay out some groundwork so you can kind of understand this. There's a settlement deep inside Denali National Park. It's an old mining settlement known as Kantishna. And that's where Greg's operation as Air Taxi and Skyline Lodge is operating out of now. But the only way you can get out there, and there's a couple other lodges out there, and this is truly backcountry. You got to generate your own power, water supply, the whole nine. It's really some backcountry stuff, and it's really amazing. It's gorgeous. But the only way you can get out to this area is you can't drive your own car out there unless you have a special permit, and they're very rare and hard to come by. So you got to take the park bus out there. And the park bus is like an old school bus on a gravel road for, was it like 6 hours one way, Greg?
Yep. 6 to 8 hours, depending what you see.
Yeah, so, you know, you'll see wildlife along the way and all that, but a lot of these lodges offer these trips, these day trips, where you ride the bus for 6 hours to get out to the lodge, and then, you know, you have lunch and do some activities. And then after that, you spend, you know, maybe an hour and a half, a couple hours in Kantishna. Then you get back on that same bus and another 6 hours back out. So all that being said, just trying to lay some groundwork for you, and this is where I think we could plug in Cantitia Air Taxi and what you've done with that, Greg. So can you kind of tell us how you got into what your aha moment was for Cantitia Air Taxi?
Sure, yeah. I'd been working at the park entrance for years, probably 3 years for the local hotel and restaurants there. I spent a couple years working for Park Service on one of their first trail crews they had, and that gave me some more days off. And through all of that, I ended up meeting, and I stayed my first winter working with this great guy, Dennis Kogel, a local guy who had 35 sled dogs, and he was looking for someone to help him run dogs for the winter. So spent the winter living in a remote cabin, hauling water, shooting moose, doing the backcountry thing with him. And for our big spring trip, we went out with the then assistant superintendent, Ralph Tingey, and his wife, Sherry, and family, and went all the way through the park on dog team, 90 miles out to Cantitia. And when we got there, met Roberta and Sam and some of the old miners that were still out there kind of kicking around, closing up shop. And they were so welcoming and so lovely, and went out there in the spring to do a little thank you for her and just, you know, repay her for her hospitality. We just went out there to do some carpentry for her for the weekend, just to give her a hand. And she offered me a job, and the park entrance had been getting larger and larger and more people and getting pretty busy. So I was looking for something a little more remote, and went out there and just jumped into her world. And she had started the Cantitia Roadhouse. Her and her husband were mining gold out there. And in 1985, they shut down all the mining in the park as the new area was encompassed in this new park preserve. And so worked for her for a year, guiding, doing some carpentry. And the whole time I'd been flying, you know, a small little plane, a little two-seater, a friend and I co-owned. And then, you know, she just kind of suggested one day, hey, you should start your own little air business. And, you know, and I'd seen other planes coming and going, and folks would come over from Talkeetna on the other side of the range. And there was a Lowell Thomas Jr., great legendary pilot, used to fly in maybe once a week from Talkeetna and do a couple scenic flights for some of the folks up at Camp Denali, and then he would fly back home. So, you know, I definitely saw the availability there of, you know, the need for aviation, and just watching what an incredible thing it was to fly around the mountain and blow people's mind how beautiful this park was, you know, and also just, it was something I just loved doing more than anything was being in the air. So I never really thought about starting a career with it, or, you know, but I realized, why not? You know, I might as well give it a go. So, yeah, with the help of another friend, we had been kind of flying together, sharing airplanes, and he had some financial backing. So he ended up basically buying our first aircraft, a Cessna 180, little four-seater, and leased it to me, and I basically ran it all summer and just would guide people during the day on hikes and then kind of chat with them during the hike. And a lot of times people want to go flying in the afternoon, so we'd go flying in the evening or late evening all the way up to, you know, 11 o'clock at night, just doing little scenic flights up to the mountain. And that was kind of the beginning. And once we got things going, it was obvious that everybody wanted to fly out to the park entrance and avoid that bus ride or go to Anchorage. There was definitely a need to get out and do other things. So then I just slowly worked with the FAA, worked really hard doing all the paperwork to become a full-fledged air taxi. And, you know, there's a lot of negotiating with Park Service and trying to establish myself there. And I had a lot of support from the local community. And eventually they, you know, authorized me to kind of do the service out there. And, you know, now I'm the only shooting match in town.
That's amazing. This story blows my mind. I think it's so interesting. And so the airstrip out in Cantitia is pretty gnarly for the most part. I think a lot of pilots wouldn't necessarily fly into there. I can think I remember something being said about that. But was that strip already there once you started flying? I mean, had it been there for a while? Or
it was, yeah. From what I can tell, it sounds like it had been established on, you know, a shoulder of Moose Creek way back in the day, probably from the 1930s, 1940s on. The miners kind of moved it around where need be to get supplies, and, you know, the old planes would come in there. And then they kind of upgraded it a bit. I know the miners, it used to be one of the dumps from what I gather, and things still come bubbling up from one side of this airstrip on occasion underneath the gravel from those days. But I know they would just, you know, mine an area and then they would just cover it over with gravel. And I think they did a bit of work on it. When I first saw it, it was probably, 1,200 feet, trees, really tall trees on all sides and in both ends. And you had to really work hard to get in there and really hard to get out of there. And I was just flying a small little Cessna 150, which is, you know, 100 horse airplane, and could barely get in and out of there. It was pretty sketchy. So, you know, but over the years, it's been extended a little bit and really taken care of. It's a contentious strip. The state of Alaska claims they still own it. Park Service claims they own it. So it's caught in this gray area they've signed a memorandum of understanding that, you know, no one can prove who actually owns it. And they're just going to let it be at this point. And Park Service is continuing to kind of manage it at this point.
So, and you're the only operator in Kantishna that has a concession to fly out of there. So what does that mean for you and your business?
Well, it allows me to, you know, be the partner, the chosen business to do the service flying folks between Kantishna and back out to the park entrance at the Denali Park Airstrip. And then also, you know, to be the ones who can fly from Kantishna around Denali, the mountain itself, and then back to Kantishna. So that just gives me a little protected, you know, business model that, you know, nobody else can come in and do that service. It's on a bid system. It's a contract that comes up for bid every 10 years. So I could always lose it, you know, if somebody else competitively came in and could do a better job and offer what we offer. But we, you know, now we have over 25 years experience and have a base of operations there and, you know, a lot of great history. So I expect that it's not much of a problem to, as long as we keep doing a good job, to keep that contract going.
Yeah. And with that said, it's pretty interesting that you have an operation there, a lodge, Skyline Lodge, where you operate out of, and it would be nearly impossible for anyone else to come in and set up shop there because it's part of the preserve now. So yes, as far as like Skyline Lodge goes, how did you acquire that land in this area, and like how did all that go down?
Yeah, that was a sheer blessing for sure. I feel really fortunate how that all happened. So over the years working at the Roadhouse, there was another mining family who had been there, the Mark Anthony family. The father had owned several pieces up and down the Kantishna Hills. And he was a mining engineer that later ended up teaching at the University of Fairbanks. And he had several sons. When he had left the area, he'd basically deeded several big plots to each of his boys. And, you know, some of them built little places on them and then sold them. Others of them hung on to it. So Mark Anthony, I think he was the oldest son, he had, you know, this 20-acre lot that, mostly all hillside, real steep area. But he was one of the last, you know, of the old miners who was out there and still had this holding. And every year I'd call him and bug him and ask him if he knew anybody else, knew any of the old miners that might have a chunk of land that's something I could get my hands on. I was renting a place from Berta originally at the Kantishna Roadhouse, just to have a small office there and a place to put some trailers and house my employees. But as we were getting bigger, the Roadhouse was sold to Doyon, which is a native corporation, and they took over. And they were very, very good about helping us and supporting us. But as we both started growing, you know, it became obvious that I needed to find my own place. So I was talking with Park Service about leasing some land from them so that I could set up, you know, a small office and some housing either down by the airstrip and once again, always calling Mike. And so kind of a Hail Mary. I was about a month away from signing a deal with Park Service. And I called Mike again and said, Mike, you know, I'm about ready to make a deal with Park Service and really don't want to go down that road. Just wondered if you know anything new. And he said, oh, man, I was just thinking about calling you. You know, I'm getting divorced and things in my life are upside down and I really need some money. And, you know, maybe we could work out a deal. And, boy, I crossed my fingers and everything came together and spent a bunch of money to get one little half acre of land on a very steep hillside, which I'm sure he was kind of laughing the whole time going, I don't know if this guy's going to pull this off. And so he came back about a year later and I had this, you know, big, beautiful lodge built, through help of a bunch of wonderful friends and my friend Roger Featon, just a mastermind in engineering and hard work. He designed a really beautiful steel foundation system that held together and held up on the steep hillside, and we were able to build everything on top of that. So, yeah, and then the next year, Mike relinquished the last half acre he had, and now I have a full acre out there. But it was the only piece of property. I think there's still 11 or 13 privately held pieces of land that are in the preserve area of the park. And, yeah, I was just super fortunate to get one of the ones, the only one that really had a workable road access and that would work for our business. So it just came into play just beautifully, and that gave us the autonomy we needed to, you know, build a nice place and a great home base for my employees, and, you know, also allowed us to build, you know, a handful of rooms for, you know, having just a, you know, about 10 guests, 10 to 12 guests a night out there. And it just creates a nice, intimate, genuine lifestyle and a great little place for people to stay. And, yeah, I really have fun doing it. It's not too big, so, you know, flying is definitely our mainstay business, but it's sure nice to have a few folks around, too, to help keep the lights on and afford to, you know, have a great chef, Christina, who's been cooking for us for years, just an amazing person, great friend, and just does wonders in the kitchen. So she's been a huge blessing for us as well.
No, that's awesome. And yeah, I'm missing Christine and her food right now. Dang it, Greg.
and you're thinner for it.
Yeah, probably so. I definitely would had my share of second helpings there. But no, I think that's what's fascinating about this whole story. It's like the stars align, but not to mention all the hard work that goes into it. I mean, dude, you're one of the hardest working people I think I've ever met. Like, I go to bed and you're still up. I get up in the morning or the afternoon whenever I decide to get up and you're already there, like sleeping, you know, very few hours a night. It's just, but I guess what I'm getting at is with your love and admiration for that area, I just feel like everything aligned for you to do what you're doing and to give back. You know, you're not, you know, I get it. You know, we're all trying to make money and all that kind of stuff, but that's not your main goal. Your main goal is to be out there and love that and share the experience. And, you know, if it wasn't for you, I never would have gotten out there. And man, I'll tell you what, that place has got a special place in my heart. So, yeah, thanks for doing that, man, and keeping it real, you know, not being some huge corporate dude that comes in there and just, you know, just rapes the land just for money and all that. It's truly one of the last frontiers. And guys, if you got some savings for vacation, you need to go to catair.com and get your ass up to Alaska. I've been all over the world, and it's the most beautiful place I've ever been. And, yeah, so do that. But at any rate, just a little plug there for you, Greg. Yeah, so with like the construction and building of the lodge, I mean, you didn't like hire a company to do that. Like you and Roger and a handful of other people like built this lodge on a hillside, mm-hmm. just on your own, right?
Yep, pretty much. I designed it, got together. That was way back in the day where computers just starting to get kind of hip, and had several log design ideas that I found in magazines and then kind of melded those with a little architect program I found online and kind of threw it together and took it to an engineer and said, what do you think about this? And he said, yeah, I think this will work. And then tried to hire a couple different contractors to come out there and do the foundation work for me. And boy, they looked at the hillside and they saw the snow coming down the hill. And this was all in late August, September. And they were like, boy, we don't want to get stuck out here. And because once it snows deep and heavy out there, they close the park road and that's it. You're going to get stuck out there for 8 months. And so that nobody wanted to take that risk. And, you know, luckily Roger, who was flying for me at the time, he, in the off season, he's a foreman and a superintendent on big building projects all over Alaska. So he said, I'll tell you what, I got 2 weeks before my next gig starts. Give me your credit card and let's get this done. And within 4 hours, we had three semis coming at us with equipment, all the metal, everything going on. I hired my friend Ted and another friend Harley. And, you know, within 2 weeks, we had the whole foundation up and raring to go, and then got another small group of maybe four or five of us that went out there and started stitching logs and getting those up. We had the duplex up by the time we left in late October in the snow, and then came back that next spring and finished up a couple other buildings. And by that end of that summer, we had the roof on and the place all put together. So literally within 6 months of building, we had the whole place put together, and we moved in the next season. So it's really remarkable. But I've been working in the trades most of my early days in Denali Park. I'm working for Rock and Roll Construction and a handful of others. And so it was really great to be able to call all my friends in the trades and get them to pitch in and help out on electric or come in and do the plumbing. And, you know, I knew everybody who either volunteered or gave me a hand in some respect. But yeah, it was just kind of like, had the ingenuity and the balls and just did it. And luckily Alaska, we built everything to code, but you know, it wasn't tied up everywhere else in the world. You have to go through planning and architects and approval, and you'll spend a year and $70,000 just to get permits to even start a project in California. And Alaska, we drew it out on a napkin and we're building within a week. So
that's crazy.
Pretty amazing.
To see how
we did it.
And I mean, and folks, like the foundation Greg is talking about, this is literally on a very steep hillside. And if you can imagine like a log cabin on stilts, this is like in a huge log cabin on stilts. This is what he's talking about. It's worthwhile to go to the website and just there's a couple videos on there we created in this past season, but you can just see the place. And if you can imagine all that taking place in a matter of 6 months when the snow's coming, it blows my mind. I just don't see how you guys did it, man.
Yeah, I look back at it, and it seems kind of crazy, but it really wasn't that hard. I mean, a lot of respects. It just all came together, a lot of planning, and yeah, I guess, you know, I look back now, and I realize why I'm so tired. it was an amazing amount of work, but I was so in love with the idea, and it was so much fun putting a group of friends together to do it, and we had an awful lot of fun, you know, working 12, 16-hour days and then drinking Crown Royal and playing Scrabble till we passed out and get up and do it again. So it was really good time. Very memorable.
Living the dream, man. I love it. Yeah. No, it's just one thing I remember about when I was in Cantishna working for you. Like, I love the fact that you'll go for it, man. Like, I remember one day, we weren't flying or whatnot, and the brakes needed to be changed on one of the vans. And you're like, here, change the brakes. I'm like, man, I'm not a mechanic. I've never changed brakes. You're like, well, just figure it out and do it. So I was like, man, this guy's crazy. But I mean, just that whole attitude of just, you know, just go for it, see what happens. And it looks like, you know, it's really worked out for you. I love the quote that, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. I try to keep that in mind as well. So you're definitely one of those guys.
Yeah, that's for certain. Yeah, you have to go for it. And, you know, but I think you mentioned it already. It's like, this is a passion. This is something I love to do. I love Denali. I love the people. I love flying more than anything. And, you know, Paulo Coelho writes in one of my favorite books, The Alchemist, you know, it's like, if you have your intention set and your heart in it, you know, basically the world will conspire to make it all happen. And that's really what I felt. I didn't do this alone, you know. I had an amazing network of support, lots of great elders who helped me along the way, given me encouragement and ideas. Yeah, it was my giddy up and go to charge after it and do it. But everywhere I turned, everyone was helping me make my dream come true. And, you know, they knew that I had this passion and love, and it wasn't just for money, and I wasn't just trying to, you know, build up a business and flip it and make a bunch of money and then go on and do something else. It's like, I really wanted to be in Denali. I really wanted to fly. I didn't do it for money. That was never my goal. And I think that's, you know, now I realize I'm making more than I ever dreamed. And, you know, I think that's just a testament of, if you do what you really love, it's all going to work out. And, you know, money's not really the end all anyway. So be careful what you wish for.
Hey, true that, man. True that. And it just goes to show, like, the laws of attraction right there working. I mean, what you put out is what you get back. That's very inspirational. You've always been very inspirational, Greg. And, I love another quote I was thinking about the other day. A lot of people live by this. They go to jobs they hate to buy things they don't need, to impress people they don't like. That's just a great saying in my mind.
So true.
What advice would you give yourself looking back to, you know, when you're sitting there reading your mail at, you know, the park entrance strip, watching these planes go off? What advice would you give to yourself knowing what you know now?
Boy, I felt really, you know, I'd probably do it all again the same. I think the big thing is to you know, take care of the people around you. You got to take care of yourself. You know, follow your heart. I think that's the biggest thing, without a doubt. It's, if it doesn't feel good, like for me, like the whole college thing, that just wasn't my gig. And as I mentioned, I remember the headhunters coming around in college, grabbing all my, you know, really smart finance people and offering them big salary jobs. And I just remember thinking, I wouldn't want any of those jobs, stuck in an office and a high rise in New York and crunching numbers. I was just like, it almost made me sick to my stomach. I couldn't see myself doing that. There was nothing there that excited me and made me feel good. In the back of my brain was burning this whole idea of, like, I just want to be in a log cabin in a wilderness setting, you know, being outside. And that's, once the thing in Alaska came in, I was like, boom, this is it. This is exactly what I'm looking for. So, you know, kind of keep putting it out there and things. I think if you work hard and, you know, I think that was maybe a goal to my success, is no matter what I did, washing dishes, bussing tables, waiting tables, bartending, pounding nails, you know, whatever. I did it really well and put my heart into it and tried to have fun doing it. And instantly people just, you know, I just always got the green light to move my way up to management, or, you know, because, you know, and I hire kids today, and man, if they can't do a good job cleaning a toilet, why am I going to, you know, give them a raise and promote them into more responsibility? It's like, I guess, you know, I just kind of befuddled by kids who want to show up and be CEO right off the bat and be making piles of money. It's, you know, you don't always have to work the way I did, but I think it's kind of the organic way to go. And had a lot of fun doing it. So, but yeah, I think, you know, stick to your guns, be true to yourself, and, you know, try to be as honest and open with others. As one guy I met in New Zealand, one day we were looking across the street and he was bemoaning the fact that here was this guy who set up shop right across from him and was, you know, basically illegally paying off all the bus drivers to stop there and bring business to their little shop instead of his shop. And he's like, I'm not worried, mate. He goes, you know, it's everybody goes up and everybody comes down. And when that guy goes down, no one's going to lend a hand to help him up. And, you know, that's always stuck with me. It's like, if you treat people like shit, you know, anytime, or you're just ruthless and after money, you know, when you start to have problems or something goes awry and you need support and help, boy, if you didn't give it on your way up, you're certainly not going to get it on the way down. So it's, you know, it's just that same thing, you know, the golden rule of treat people like you want to be treated. And it does really work out in the end. You know, it's been, I've been super, super, I like to say lucky, but you know, I've made a lot of my breaks and right place, right time. And yeah, and just, I feel very, very fortunate to have remained alive and we have not had an accident or incident in 25 years of pretty heavy flying in the Alaska range. And, you know, every year I lose a friend, you know, to an airplane crash. And it's been, I wonder, you know, what the deal is. Why am I so lucky? What are the keys? You know, I think I use good judgment. I back away. I'm getting more conservative every year. I'm trying to impress that on my pilots that it's, you know, it's more important to get back on the ground alive than to, you know, try to complete a mission or push it to the point of no return. So it's I don't know what the secret is there other than, you know, I feel super fortunate that we've made it this far and got to find some wood to knock on. Cause
yeah, getting it for you right now.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I think you definitely make very calculated, I don't know, I guess risk or whatever, but you know, I think you just run your own high octane all the time, man. I remember when we were doing a doors off flight and shooting some promotional video for you, and me and my brother in the back of the plane with the door off shooting video and flying in formation there or whatever, and the plane stalls. And I'm like, oh my God, we're going down. What is going on? Like, I had no idea that you had just ran one of the gas tanks out in one of the wings and were switching to the other one. I thought, like, at that moment, I was scared shitless. But it was a great flight. It was one of the best flights ever, man. Like, it was always fun flying with you. You know, the other guys are great as well, but you could just tell there's a lot more passion with you when you're flying and you're in the zone, and it's cool seeing you in your element, man. So it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing up there. It's one of the most beautiful places on the planet, like you mentioned.
Yeah, and what's cool about it is the days are long, so you know, I remember us flying up till, you know, like 11 o'clock at nights, and the alpenglow on the mountain is just fantastic. It's where the sun's kind of setting and it gets this pink and, you know, warm yellows and orange, you know, tones on the mountain. It looks gorgeous up there at night. But you know, it's like every flight you go on it's not the same. I mean, the places are the same, but it's never, you know, the unique features are always going to be there, but it never looks the same, man. I could never get tired of it. I never got tired of going up in an airplane and just being in that environment. It's just like time stands still, and it's such a gorgeous place. So folks, if you have the chance, it's, you got to get up there. I swear you will thank us. So,
indeed.
Yeah. So, what do you do in your spare time when you're not working in Alaska?
Lots of different things. Elise and I travel quite a bit. We're big fans of, the Southwest, the Northwest, California. We spend a lot of times, fall season rundown, usually hit California for music and hiking and biking. Elise is a naturalist guide who does, you know, great trips all over the planet. So we do quite a bit of travel. We both started guiding in Antarctica in the last 4 or 5 years. So that's been really exciting, getting out to the Falkland Islands, South Georgia Island, and down in the Antarctic Peninsula. So that's kind of been mind-blowing, fun experience. We're hoping to get over to Croatia next year, do some sailing, maybe a bike ride through Europe. And there's just always, you know, we're getting a little older now, and part of me would love to be settled in one area and start to build a little more community. I do miss that, but you know, once we sit down for more than a couple months, we both start just bubbling, you know, craving the next thing or seeing something online and going, oh God, look at that place in South Africa. We got to go check that out. So it's, you know, it's just, we just feel so fortunate that we're on this planet, this time of life, you know, where you can hop on an airplane and be jettisoned over to, you know, the other side of the world in a day and a half and, you know, realistically still see the most beautiful things on the planet. And as long as I can keep doing that, I'm going to keep checking it all off, because it's been really phenomenal just to be able to see this planet and live the way we do. And, you know, but it takes a lot of work and a lot of effort, and, you know, working seasonally is not for everybody. I can see why people crave routine and would love to get into that, you know, 9-to-5 thing, but I can't imagine living a life where I only have 2 weeks off. I mean, I work a 100-day season, and probably, you know, realistically, I probably work 6 months, but I know I put in more than a full-time job.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, but then I have my, you know, usually 4 to 6 months off where I can do what I want to do. And to me, that's just, you know, I call it pre-retirement, and I've been doing it for the last 30 years. So it's giving, you know, I've been around the globe 6 different times, and yeah, just wouldn't trade it for the world. It's the best thing ever. And it's just opened my eyes to different cultures, different beliefs, you know, and what an amazing planet we are on, and also, you know, the reality of what kind of trouble we are creating for this planet. So hopefully we can bring some more awareness to that and turn this thing around before it gets out of hand. It's already out of hand, but
no, you mentioned just being able to travel. I mean, the way you can get across the entire world in a day and a half. It's amazing how feasible it is to travel these days, and how, you know, I think I didn't get a passport until I was, you know, 28, and I was trying to work my way up the corporate ladder and just got there and was like, this is it? This sucks. I hate this. So I did what anybody would do and pulled the plug and got a seasonal job as a heavy machine operator in Antarctica. Mm-hmm. Never thought I would do that, but no, I definitely agree with you. It's a great big world out there, and just the more I see of it, the more I want to see. So I think that's something we share. And I can't get away from people that have been to Antarctica. So have you been on all 7 continents now?
I have. Yep. Antarctica was my last. So I stepped foot on there probably 4 or 5 years ago, my first trip down. Yeah, and it's a good friend I've known him for 30 years. He used to guide in Denali, he used to be a neighbor up there. He's been guiding in Antarctica, expedition leader on a small expedition ship for the last, 25 years probably. And so Elise, my partner, got a job with Lindblad Expedition. She was going down on her first journey. And so I kind of put it out there trying to get on her ship to go, but it looked like it was going to be full. And I just, once again, creating my own opportunities, I just called everybody I knew who guides down there and said, hey, there's an opening on your boat, or should I just show up in town and see if there's an open berth last minute? Maybe I can hop on. And so sure enough, Hugh called me, you know, and said, can you be in Antarctica in, you know, 5 days, or down in Ushuaia, which is the tip of Argentina. And he said, I can get you on this boat and, you know, might be able to give you a pretty good deal on it. And you won't be crew or anything, but you'd just be coming along for the trip. And I was like, hell yeah. So I flew down there and got on the boat, and it was just the most mind-bending, you know, three-week trip. Falkland Island, South Georgia, back to Peninsula, and just saw the most amazing things and some of the best wildlife sightings on the planet. And wow, that was it. And so, and then I've been another 2 times as guide and Zodiac driver working with another company. So that's been just mind-blowingly beautiful and fun, and great people that you meet along the way, and it draws a real diverse crowd of folks who, you know, really want to see some of the last greatest, you know, biodiversity frontiers on the planet. So really feel super fortunate being able to have that all come together for me and make that work.
Yeah, likewise. I remember the first time I got to Antarctica, which I flew in, so, you know, it's a one minute I'm in sunny green Christchurch, New Zealand, with a t-shirt and shorts on. The next, you know, 5 hours later, I'm stepping onto a frozen ocean. And it was literally, I remember that when I got off the plane and the first sighting I had of Antarctica, I was just like, holy shit, what have I done? And this, I felt like I was on Mars or just an entirely different planet.
Yeah, you know, you're a long ways away when you're down there, for sure.
Yeah, but I think you're right. Like everybody I've met that's, you know, while in Antarctica or while, or that's been, you know, or just travel in general, there's everybody just has this common thing. I don't even know what it is. A sense of adventure. Yeah. Partly that, partly, I don't know what it is. It's just like something in everybody's eyes that just, you know, just intrigued to go see something like that. I talked to a lot of people and like, you did what? You went where? Like, why would you do that? And I'm like, why wouldn't you do that? Are you crazy? And they're like, are you crazy? I'm like, I can't even talk to you. I got to go. So, yeah, no, I totally understand what you're saying about how you just meet incredible people. I mean, that's, you know, that's how I met you and ended up in Alaska. And, you know, I think everybody that in that crew as well just shares the same kind of whatever that thing is, wanderlust or whatever you want to call it. But sense of adventure for sure.
Sure.
It's interesting.
No, passion for something different. And yeah, I think once you instill that and get that going, it just continues to feed you with so much energy that it's, you know, I don't know if I get bored easily. Or one thing I realized the other night, I was watching a movie about a war correspondent, and this little Pakistani guy said something about, well, you know, or Afghan guy said that, you know, most of the pharmaceutical narcotics, you know, opiates come from our country. And he said, but watching you guys, I realize, you know, the human body produces adrenaline, epinephrine, endorphins, you know, basically anybody in a high, exciting, risk-filled job like something I do, or surfers, or anybody who charges, you know, that's that juice we get. We produce our own little high, and so we tend to become little adrenaline junkies. And I realized, wow, this is kind of the story of my life, you know, and like traveling on the back of a tuk-tuk, you know, driving 6 miles an hour through Bangkok traffic.
Oh, or God, dude, that's crazy.
Getting chased by, you know, gun-toting militia folks in Nepal during a coup, or, you know, there's like, I don't know how many places I've been where there's been uprising, coups, overthrows, you know, right in front of me, and just like, oh my God, it's like, duck.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just glad to get out of it alive, but it's just been phenomenal. So it's hard to just sit home and, yeah, and I go back to Michigan now and twiddle my thumbs and just can't wait to get out, because I just can't imagine just being in one spot. You know, I just can't. TV doesn't do it for me.
So. No, I hear you, man. And one thing on that, I learned early on when I was traveling and, you know, places that are not America, that I would always wear like running, or like I'd wear Chuck Taylors everywhere I went, to the beach, wherever. People would be like, why are you wearing Chuck Taylors to the beach? I'm like, well, if shit hits the fan and I need to run, I'm not going to be in flip-flops trying to run away. And like nobody could understand that. I don't know if it was just me being paranoid or whatever, but there was an instance where I did have to run at one point. It was not necessarily had to run, but it felt like the thing to do. So that was my pro tip always, is always be able to run in the footwear that you have on.
Yeah. Amen. Yeah. Be ready to bolt.
Well, cool, Greg. Well, man, I appreciate you being on. Is there anything else you want to touch on, or have we missed anything that you'd like to add?
No, other than, you know, people always wonder about, you know, getting into aviation. It's a long go to get into it. I see a lot of new pilots, you know, between the cost increasing, the training's way extensive right now, and more rules and regs and FAA's throwing in a lot of roadblocks, you know, to entry to get into being a pilot. But it's really, you know, it's something that you just, once you get that skill and something that you do, you know, don't hold back. If it makes you happy and something really makes you excited, you know, you'll find a way to make it go. And I think just with that, though, I guess, you know, the only advice I have is, you know, set your ego aside, you know, make sure you create your own personal limits of what's comfortable for you, what kind of weather you want to fly in, when do I turn around, you know, and stick to that no matter what, you know, because that's the only reason I see all these friends of mine dying every year. I think they just got comfortable pushing it, and you know, eventually they pushed it too far. So it's stuffing that ego in the back seat and just doing what's right instead of, you know, trying to get there or prove the point that you're such a great pilot that you can get there, you know, and putting yourself and other people in danger. And then, you know, the only other advice I'd have, you know, big thing is like, listen to your elders. You know, I mean, between the amazing flight instructors that I had that were always, you know, saying, oh, I had a friend who died because of this. And I had a friend, see that little gizmo right there? Well, that thing iced up at 12,000 and he ended up dying. And, you know, so, I mean, and everywhere I've gone flying, you know, first thing I do is call the local flight instructor, call local pilot, get the scoop, sit down, find out what kills people, find out what the dangers are. And I see all these old senior citizens, old pilots who are sitting on the sidelines. No one's talking to them because they're not in the game anymore. And people these days, I notice a lot of people seem to dismiss or they just take for granted the wealth of knowledge of all these amazing people who are still around and our elders and have so much to teach us if we just ask them. And man, you ask one little question and they'll throw all kinds of nuggets of goodness at you. And that's just, I think that's been one of my successes. Everywhere I go, I humbled myself and just sat down and said, teach me what you know. And man, everybody sat down without a hesitation to just open up and share with me, you know, wisdom to keep me alive because I think that just shows a sign of good judgment and also deference to your elders. And, you know, everyone wants to be respected and pass on that knowledge. But if you don't ask, you know, all this stuff just goes by the wayside because you think you're God's gift to aviation. And the old guys just sit there in the hangar and shake their head as they watch you go off and make giant mistakes or, you know, even worse, you know, go out and hurt somebody or kill yourself. So that would be my only advice there. And
well, I think that goes a long way for any industry, man. I mean, that's doesn't matter what it is. Yeah, just listen to the folks that have been there before. I feel like, you know, seeing this like the millennial age or whatever you want to call it, or, you know, it's a lot of I just see it time and time again that people just, you know, feel entitled for no reason and like they're owed something when they haven't put in the work. So just going back to that statement you were saying about if you're not good at scrubbing a toilet, there's no way you're going to be a great CEO. That's so millennials out there, learn to scrub toilets really, really well. You can practice on mine. Come on over.
Yeah. Just, you know, realize that life is all about doing every little thing. And just because you're soldier.com company and you're worth $300 million now doesn't mean that, you know, you shouldn't pitch in and help out and help your neighbor and, you know, do your part because you're still human. So we're all there trying to get along.
Greg, I love your story, man. I love everything about it. It's, you know, there's definitely trials and errors and all that kind of stuff, but it's very inspiring. And I really appreciate you sharing everything with me and the listeners out there.
Yeah, well, thanks. Thanks, Whit. And I appreciate everything you've done, too, to help, you know, promote and foster what we do. And, you know, just getting this, you know, getting my story in an audio profile is always a wonderful thing, something I've been wanting to do. So I appreciate you making the effort to make that happen.
Oh, yeah. And you know me, and we worked together all season to create the promotional stuff for your website and whatnot. And I don't know if it was me or giving you the nudge or not, but I'm like, Greg, we got to get this website going, or if you already had it in mind. But I'm honored to be a part of that. And folks, if you want to see some of the images and the videos that we shot, I mean, I feel like it's some of my best work to this day, and I'm very proud of it. You can go check it out at Kat, that's KATAIR.com, KatAIR.com. And you can check out everything else with Kantishna Air Taxi and Denali National Park and all that goodness up there in Alaska. So yeah, I'm glad to be a part of it as well. I know we talked about doing some type of interview with you as well before I left and getting it on tape. And that was before I had the podcast. So it just seems that it just worked out this way. So yeah, I'm glad we got a chance to sit down. But before we go, I got a couple random mystery questions for you. Which I like to end each segment with, just to see where your head goes. So, are you ready?
Yeah, lay it on me.
All right, buddy. If you could have one superhuman or one superhero power, what would it be?
Non-superhero power. I would have to say, yeah, that whole leaping buildings with a single bound, you know, the flying aspect, being able to kind of cruise around somehow flying, that would be my goal. To do it without a machine would be amazing.
Yeah, I could see that one coming. I was thinking either that or you'd say teleportation. That would be mine. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great one too.
Okay, so those Amber Alert signs you see on the highway, if you could hijack one of those, what message would you try to get across, or would you get across?
I had a dream a few years ago that the Dalai Lama walked up to me and smacked me in the forehead and looked at me straight in the eye and said, "Wake up." And I think that's what would be my thing. Like, wake up, stop what you're doing, get off the treadmill for a little bit, and just kind of look around you and really be aware of where you are and what this world and this reality is about, and start being who you want to be. And, you know, and there's so many great places and groups of people doing some really great work these days. And, you know, make it meaningful. Be part of a community. Do things to make the world a better place. You know, we can't count on our government to do anything. We can't count on anybody to do anything. So you have to be that change you want to see in the world, as Gandhi said. You know, and just take that to heart, and it'll make your life just amazing, and it'll make the rest of the planet amazing. So to me, it's like, stop, get off this, you know, take a little break and just take some time to sit and be who you are and who you want to be, and then move in that direction instead of just feeling swept away or living in fear or worry that you don't have enough money or you don't have the nice house or you're trying to keep up with the Joneses. I think that's the lesson I keep telling myself, is like, slow down and, you know, move forward with intention, and things are going to be so much better.
No, that's great. I love it.
Yeah.
All right. If you could be any dinosaur, which would you be? I think I might know where this one's going as well, but go on.
Well, yeah, it's that ever since I saw the Velociraptor, I think that would have to be, although I think it's a little aggressive for my particular style and taste, I guess, to be the badass flying thing out there. That's kind of what I would want to be, I think.
Pterodactyl. So.
Yeah, Velociraptor.
Yeah, I think that is a little aggressive for your laid back personality.
But yeah, if you're gonna be a flying creature, that would be a great one.
All right, I love this one. If you were a professional fighter, what would be your ring entry music when you're entering the ring? What's playing?
I would say, that first comes to mind is Eye of the Tiger.
Yes.
And I don't know why that is. I think that goes back to when I was in college on the soccer team. I think we used that song to rev ourselves up for the before the game. So that kind of sticks in my head as a great one to run in there and get myself all pumped up.
Well, that's the Rocky joint as well, right?
I'm not sure if it is or not. It might have been. There's so many Rocky films.
Yeah, which one? Yeah, they just came out with a new one.
It could. Oh God.
Did you see that? The new. Well,
no.
It's Rocky training.
Oh right.
Was it Creed or something?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's average at best, but whatever. They're continuing the brands. I mean, they're bleeding that turnip dry, brother. They're still going after it.
Yep. Amen, amen.
Okay, last and not least, if you could have drinks with anyone, dead or alive, who would it be?
That would be a toss-up. I think if I could take two people... It would either be Einstein or the Dalai Lama. And I'd probably do the Dalai Lama probably be drinking tea. But if I could get both of them together, that would be the best. Yeah, either one of those guys would be the two top dogs in my world.
Well, I like it. That's a good response. And with that, I have nothing left for you, Greg. I think I've all right. tapped all the information out of you, so I appreciate you being on the podcast today. And if people want to find out more about you, where can they find you at?
You can always go through our website. You can email info@katair.com. That's KATAIR.com. And my office will get that message to me. And yeah, I'd be glad to respond to anybody who's trying to get into flying or interested about Alaska or, you know, starting something new. I'm always open to talk and help and mentor and give any tidbits of advice or help for others, because I certainly got a lot of help and advice going through my pathway. So I realize that's part of my giving back now is doing what I can to bring others up the same way. And it's the only way we're going to keep creating a better world.
Yeah. And I think, Greg, that's awesome. And I really appreciate you doing that, because I think a lot of people are afraid to ask for help and just assume that the people that are in places where they are of success or, you know, whatever you want to say, just, you know, they did it all on their own. They got there by themselves. So yeah, folks, people just want to help people as well. So that's a great notion, Greg. And thanks for giving back to us, man.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, all right. Well, don't hurt yourself out there surfing today in Hawaii. And
all right,
I will,
brother.
Talk to you later, man.
All right, Whit. Love you, brother. You be well.
All right. Love you guts, man. Talk to you later.
All right. Aloha. Bye-bye.
Once again, if you are interested in learning more about sponsorship incentives, or if you have any questions that you think would be a good fit for this format, or if you have someone in mind in which you would recommend to be interviewed on the podcast, then email me at whit@whitaldridge.com. That's whit@whitaldridge.com. I've been your host, Whit Aldridge, and I look forward to next time.